Coming to you from Cincinnati's Computer Cooperative Studios, you're listening to Hemp Rock Radio on WBQC LP Cincinnati 95.7 FM. WBQC LP, as a community radio station, serves only to open its airwaves to responsible, divergent points of view. WBQC LP does not endorse any political campaign or candidates. The opinions expressed on Hemp Rock Radio do not reflect the views of WBQC LP, Media Bridges, its staff, or Board of Trustees. The opinions expressed reflect the views of Hemp Rock and our guests. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Hemp Rockers, to Radio Free Queen City and the Monday edition of Hemp Rock Radio with the happy Hemptress and joint hosts, the Burn Man and the Dope Boy Pot and Hash, featuring the Pottsbury Bakery and Hemp Rock Cafe on WBQC LP 95.7 FM, the voice of the Queen City.
.7 is online at WVQC.org. Hemp Rock is at HempRock.com, and the Hemp Rock Hemp Line is at 513-684-HEMP. That's 513-684-HEMP.
To talk to us during the show, call 513-564-9600. That's 513-564-9600.
And now, here's Hemp Rock Radio with all things hemp, marijuana, the drug war, and more, including guests, music, news, food, and lots of fun here on 95.7 FM WVQC LP, low power to the people.
Hey, folks, this is Hemp Rock Radio. I am the Happy Hemptress, and oh, there we go. You got it. We'll be back in just a few minutes, because we are about to enter the Hemp Twilight Zone. We'll be back.
Dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone. His name is Arch Hammer. He's 36 years old. He's been a salesman, a dispatcher, a truck driver, a con man, a bookie, and a part-time bartender. This is a cheap man, a nickel and dime man, with a cheapness that goes past the suit and the shirt, a cheapness of mind, a cheapness of taste, a tawdry little shine on the seat of his conscience, and a dark room squint at a world whose sunlight has never gotten through to him. But Mr. Hammer has a talent discovered at a very early age. This much he does have. He can make his face change. He can twitch a muscle, move a jaw, concentrate on the cast of his eyes. And he can change his face. He can change it into anything he wants. Mr. Archie Hammer, jack of all trades, has just checked in at 3:80 a night with two bags, some newspaper clippings, a most odd talent, and a master plan to destroy some lives.
You can't fool me.
Help.
You're lying. You're no policeman. Why can't you leave me alone? I know who you are. I know what you are.
Woman living in a nightmare. An old woman who has fought 1,000 battles with death and always won. Now she's faced with a grim decision, whether or not to open a door. And in some strange and frightening way, she knows that this seemingly ordinary door leads to the Twilight Zone.
Traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
All right. If you did just tune in, it is the Twilight Hemp Zone today. And many more things beyond even Twilight Zone. And I'm very pleased to speak. Hopefully he's on the line. George, are you there? Did we lose you? Uh-oh. That's what I was afraid of. I have a feeling we lost him. So I'll tell you what, Chuck, let me redial him. You go ahead and talk about what's going on with Hemp Rock TV and stuff. I'm going to give you the mic for a minute because I think we lost George.
Okay. Hemp Rock TV, we got the March coming up. I don't have a schedule here in front of me. Northern Kentucky, though. Just about every night after 1 a.m. in the morning on Channel 21 on to about 5 o'clock in the morning. There's always some programs on. Working on putting another one on right now. It'll be here on Media Bridges pretty soon. Cannabis Cures Prostate Cancer. It's just a documentary. It's cured people's prostate cancer. There's no need to go under the knife.
So anyway, we're going to move forward now. Obviously, you heard the clip if you were listening. And George, I'm so glad you got to hear it. First of all, this is George Clayton Johnson on the phone from California with us. The second time, I'm proud to say he is our guest. And so thank you for that, George, and I'm glad you got to hear that little clip that I put together for you.
I thought it was juicy. It was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, obviously, I didn't make the stuff that I used to put it together, but as you know, two of those clips that were in there, or the two that I used, were your shows. And one was The Four of Us Are Dying. Originally, All of Us Were Dying, right?
Yes, All of Us Are Dying.
And then the second one, of course. You know
the
what it was.
Collaboration with Rod Serling.
Yes.
Who took my windshield wiper and put a car under it. You know, I thought it was wonderful the way he adapted the short story, which is sort of has its own reality. And then this wonderful, dark, tilted, nightmarish story, you know. And I, when I saw it, I was just totally entranced. I thought, God, we are a team, me and this Rod. We wanted to do execution together the same way. The Albert Salmi is a cowboy being hung in a noose, and only he vanishes from the noose. It's a time machine story, and he's brought into the present time.
You know, I tried to find a clip from the beginning of that last night, and I could not find it anywhere on the web, but I remember that. Now, my question, of course, would be, because of who we are, that was a hemp noose, wasn't it?
Indeed, it was a hemp and rope, as they called it.
So let's remind everybody, of course, the way that I know you, besides your work, is with Jack Hare. You're one of Jack's best friends. And so we had George on for the celebration of Jack's life during the anniversary. For his birthday recently, last month on June 18th. And you can find that archive up at WEED Radio Network if you did not hear that show with George. It was a fantastic show. And so let's move forward so people know who you are. You were the writer of 7 episodes of Twilight Zone and worked with Rod Serling, one of my favorite shows, and some of my favorite episodes, including Kick the Can, the one that made it into the 1970s movie, as well as co-writer of the original Ocean's 11. Now, I want to mention that in a minute, but so we'll come back to that in a minute, but also Logan's Run. And I know that you're working on a new one coming out. How's that going for Logan's Run?
Well, typical. You know, there are those days when you wake up and your mind is blank. You're not doing anything. You're very discouraged. You're looking around. There's tons of things to be done before anything will really happen. And then you think, this too shall pass. Because it does. That's part of the process when you want to tear it all up and walk away after giving weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years to some notion, idea that's made out of, vapor. But making a profession out of that forced me to come to terms with the idea that the new literature is realism with a touch of the imaginary. And that addition of the touch of the imaginary, really specialized by Ray Bradbury, who was my hero.
I love
and
Ray, too.
And when I saw the way he would do stories that would question things like, who are you really, you know?
Right.
Who are you? What? And if you did not have consciousness, how could you describe that to somebody? To be aware that you're aware. You know that?
Yeah.
That it's a vast inner realm of reality. And a lot of it consists of things that aren't yet, but will be. You know, like there was, before there was a helicopter, there was somebody making a drawing of something that looked a little like a butterfly. And so that's where irreality, unreality, becomes reality. You know, and it's destined that everything that's unreal will eventually become real, be realized, be whatever that word really means when you grok something totally, you get it. And anyway, I'd like to work on that kind of a frontier. You know, for me, it's limitless. The ideas, the things that can come of just adding a touch of strange, a touch of the imaginary. They call it imagination, but that word is too puzzling to think about. But what's imaginary? You know, a little toy truck that can talk. It's a trite idea. It's been thought of many, many, many times, but it's still one day, and perhaps already, they've got a little toy truck that talks, and you can buy it in a toy store.
Yeah.
And so an idea becomes a real thing. And for me, the popular culture is where I was nourished, where I grew up. I understand comics. I understand radio. I understand television, movies, books, comics. And the list is endless. It gets into charts, it gets into diagrams, it gets into systems, and it's our consciousness is leaking into the world as the world sort of leaks into our consciousness. But I can feel it's a dual thing.
Yeah.
I like being part of it, frankly. And I think just the whole idea of making a living for over 50 years without having a job.
That is a job.
And yet being productive and signing on for gigs. You know, I'll be with you for 12 weeks, but at the end of that time, I go my way. And that independence of the freelance creative person, and I could have done it just as easily in painting or in music or in something else, I'm sure, if I got interested in it. But I got interested in radio drama. Just that whole idea fascinated me. Right now, I'm making a bunch of little CDs that are readings by me of literary materials with sound effects and music to make little movies for the ear. And then I've been experimenting with ways to illustrate those movies so that they become DVDs as well as CDs. It's a whole experimental realm that I'm very interested in.
And you're the voice?
A television show for the cell phone.
And you're the voice. You do the voiceover for it, for these things.
Yes, I'm the voice of the
ear. Fantastic.
Of these short stories. The disc is called The Fictioneer. I haven't made it available out there yet. I'm thinking of maybe doing it as an e-thing, you know.
Fantastic.
Where people don't have to buy the disc, they just download it if
they're interested. Sure. With your new website that's coming soon.
Yes, I'm kind of gearing up. I'm looking for a couple of publishers. I got some books. Well, I've figured out how to do them and what to do, and just waiting for the hard hand of labor to step in and take the imaginary and make it real.
Right. Wow, fantastic. Now, you know, we talk a lot about the Twilight Zone, obviously, because that was so big. But now there was one other thing that was just as big that most people aren't aware that you also wrote. And, of course, that's The Man Trap, the second episode that aired for Star Trek in the 60s. And it's funny, it's one of the ones that I quote a lot of times when talking about health and what the body needs and stuff. It's, of course, you know, the one where the salt monsters that, of course, can change the way they look and appear like a beautiful woman, and but they need salt to survive, and their little fingers are the little suckers that, like I guess an octopus suckers, would suck the salt out of the bodies of the humans or whoever their prey was. And I think that's in the essence of human nature, or not nature, but the nature of human, that we need salt to survive as well. I mean, people actually can die.
It's a science in science fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you got science fiction, you got the made-up stuff, but underneath it all is simple things like the fact that the human body contains so much salt that we absolutely need it.
Yeah. One of the things that that is burned into my mind, I asked you once when we were sitting at a hemp shop in California together. What was it that yourself and guys like Rod Serling and all the different writers of fantasy, fiction, sci-fi, whatever you want to call it, the good stuff as far as I'm concerned, what was it that you guys were really trying to do? And your answer to me was that you guys were doing the work of consciousness expansion. And for me, that says it all, because as I told you then, well, I want you to know personally, from my perspective, it worked. I don't claim to be all, you know, wise and everything, but I certainly feel my consciousness has been uplifted and expanded due to the work that you guys have done, and yourself specifically.
I remember the back pages of Pulp magazines with little ads on them, and the little ads would say, "Your consciousness expanded!" ! You know? And then you would know that for 25 cents, you could get in on The Secret of the Age.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is really a noble undertaking to try to expand what we think of as sort of like human consciousness, you know? Like Star Trek did that for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
A lot of people had not thought of the space age at all, but suddenly it became very homey and understandable, you know, and everybody dressed in jumpsuits.
Well,
what a simple society.
I like to say, and this applies to all of it, specifically Star Trek and Twilight Zone, but it's teaching metaphysics. That's what I believe. And metaphysics, of course, for me is everything, and I think that that's where the realm of thought goes. And it's so funny. There was somebody a few years ago, well, probably over a couple of decades ago now, out of Columbus, Ohio, was teaching a class called Learning Metaphysics Through Star Trek, and I went, huh, I could teach the class. So that's where I think I've learned most of this kind of stuff, is through the work of sci-fi. Now, I want to, real quick, you're starting with Comic-Con this Thursday. That starts this weekend?
Yes.
And that is where? Tell us about that.
I've been doing it forever, it seems, over 40 years.
Wow.
And I know most of the big-name cartoonists.
Yeah.
I don't know them personally, but I know what people who know people who know people. A very, very close association with lots of really, really notable folks. And having had the opportunity to meet them, a lot of them,
yeah,
over these many years, I think it's really expanded my awareness. I think cartoonists are the cream of the crop, illustrators. You know?
Yeah.
My friend Frank Kelly Fries just died recently. For me, a year or two is still recent. And there was a guy who didn't try to bluff. He didn't consider himself an artist, though he was doing the work of an artist. He considered himself an illustrator. And of all things, his hero was Ed Cartier, an illustrator of the period, you know, that produced people like Virgil Finlay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a product of all of that popular culture, and I use it. I'm aware that you can change the culture by the introduction of a new idea,
yeah,
or a fresh idea, and expressed in cinematic terms, the audience goes for it. So
it's the modern myth. I look at that as modern myth. Today's myth is in the fantasy.
It allows me to be a cultural revolutionary.
Yeah,
because now, without risking my body and my life, I can espouse concepts or ideas.
Yeah,
like. You were talking earlier about this 1960s phenomenon we called the youth quake. It happened out of the late 50s, 58, 59.
Mm-hmm.
I went to my first world convention, that science fiction convention, in 57. I met Robert Silverberg there. He was just a very young man also. We both were accompanied by our wives. Anyway, I look back at that idea of being in on the inception of science fiction fandom. It was maybe 20, 30 years had been around before I arrived, but I arrived at just the right time to pick up on the upswing of the pulp magazines, the appearance of paperback books in news racks, in bus stations, and my God, for a quarter you can buy, you know, Jane Eyre, and man, there you go. You've got it. And I watched all of that happening around me and took part in it. As a boy, I actually played craps for comic books.
Wow.
I've thrown out the dice to try to win comic books, because you could comic books with covers on them were worth about three times as much as comic books without the covers.
Yeah.
Because they would tear off the covers so that they would prove that they had not sold.
Right, right. That's the...
You know, so... I grew up in that era, and now I look about and I think, well, the future is coming, and one can see it happening. Like, minute I met Jack Herer, I knew he was onto a golden thing.
Yes, he was.
That this, the idea of him having been ignored all these years and actually needing to be reintroduced to a public that as little as 50, 60 years before that was growing it as a cash crop in all over Kentucky and Ohio and places you wouldn't imagine could produce all the toe sacking and the what they used when they were picking cotton, huge sacks made out of lightweight cotton that they would stuff the cotton bolls into and drag down the rows and pick as they picked the cotton, and all of those bags being made by Kentucky-based outfits growing it in the form of hemp, which made a great fiber, and then you found out about food and fuel and medicine and the need for energy and the potential for energy in the quick growth of this sunlight-loving plant called hemp. Its only real drawback is that it's a mild euphoric. Otherwise, it'd be in constant use everywhere. You know, it's just But some people demonized it, made up a new word, marijuana, to conceal the fact that we're talking about hemp, folks. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you were talking about something exotic from the Far East, or where the hell that word comes from.
Or Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico. So I watched that, and so it's my kind of a mind is one that reaches out and grabs for any kind of novelty. If I see it in speech, you know, I hear a phrase. I know that phrase is going to become a catchphrase.
Mm-hmm.
I know how quickly it's going to penetrate the society. And before long, everybody will be saying crash instead of spent the night. You know, I crashed. And what does that mean? I don't know. It meant you slept on somebody's sofa.
Right.
Or maybe on the carpet. Who knows? You know, it's such a wonderfully versatile lingo that you immediately grab it and you know that the public's going to go for it. And if you can get it into an early story, you almost get a patent on it, you know?
Right.
So ideas are everything. You know, my goodness, let me wax lyrical for a moment because I really feel what I'm trying to express here.
Okay.
The universe as we know it is magical. If you wish for something badly enough that it stops being a want and becomes a need, then it will come to pass. The universe will reshape itself so that you'll meet that person, or whatever it is takes to guide you toward your heart's desire, whatever it may be, so that intention is a great deal to do with everything. You know, if you lay a rock down in some spot with great intention for it to stay there, you may be able to come back in a year and nobody will have kicked it or moved it. You know, there it is. Because of the intention that was put into it. Because I believe the universe is responsive to that sort of thing.
Yes.
I think that wishing on a star or on anything else is a meaningful act. You know, I don't think that what we call fantasy is fantasy at all. It's just unrealized reality. But when we come to realize and recognize it, you know, who could believe that two odorless, colorless, and as far as I know, dry gases, when put together, get wet? You know, who would believe that? But they do. And who could even believe that we're talking about gases here? Because you look at it, it's not a gas. It's invisible. It's colorless. It's odorless. You know, what is that?
Yeah.
That's magic. We clothe it in language and think we understand it, but we don't know what a photon is. We talk blithely about photons. We do not know what it is. We've got an idea of what some of its characteristics are.
Yeah, we can describe it.
But what is it? I don't know what it is. And almost everything that I know is hearsay. I read it somewhere. I heard it someplace. It was spoken on from on high. It was proclaimed again and again. And so I heard it, and it's part of my vocabulary, but it's all hearsay. And I only have a couple of systems for being able to detect the truth, and ironically, a lot of them don't have to do with logic. They have to do with something's fishy here, or this doesn't add up. When we use those kind of phrases, what we're talking about is improbabilities that are embedded in all kinds of possibilities. But improbabilities, and then too many, too soon, and you stop believing because it's, you know, there's a velocity to the introduction of ideas. If you introduce them too slowly, you bore the audience. If you introduce them too quickly, you confuse the audience. To be able to sense who you're talking to and know what their comprehension level is, you will adjust your tone and your voice accordingly. And people do that. There's the self-making of the self. The self you are going to become, you are choosing right now. You know, and the fact that that sort of change is happening, or that there's such a thing as sight. Good God, what an incredible idea. That with an organ you can perceive what is going on way the hell over there through some method that nobody really quite can explain called sight. And everybody has it. A lizard has it. But isn't it insanely incredible that there should be such a thing? You know, or hearing, or taste, or any of the other organs? Or isn't it really wonderful that we're geared to a music language and a spoken language? And I understand there were 1,500 different languages from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego on the Western Hemisphere.
Wow.
Amongst the populations that inhabited those regions from the top to the bottom, 1,500 different languages, dialects, ways of communicating, and communication itself is just a marvelously weird idea. And also just to be aware, to be conscious, is so astonishing that nothing else seems astonishing beside it. You know, existence. What is it? Why should there it be anything at all? Not emptiness, not planets, but nothing. You know, why not nothing?
Yeah.
Who chose it this way? And when you start trying to question the whole setup, you know it's a rigged game. And then everybody comes up with the invention. Oh, let's call it God.
Yeah.
There's some invisible spirit. You know, I think consciousness is out there. I don't think it's in your head.
Yeah.
I think your head is a method for detecting consciousness.
Like a radio.
Like a radio. You can tune it in, and when you get it tuned in properly, boy, you're part of the morphic field. Everybody
yeah.
you meet
yeah.
is thinking the same thoughts that you are. You
yeah.
know? Because ideas sort of float around like clouds, and you wander into the idea, and then everybody in the idea is thinking about Abraham Lincoln. Why? They don't know. It's in the morphic cloud. The morphic cloud is Abraham Lincoln. And each of us leaves that behind us, I'm sure. There's some undetectable reality that is going on that we do not perceive in with any of our senses, except possibly the sense of intuition, which is just knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, the snail doesn't know what about sight, but if it comes up against a wall or a rock, it'll turn aside and go some other way. And there's some kind of a mentality going on there. And I think that the whole bloody thing is aware, and that we're all tapped in on it. And I actually think hair is an instrument, a tool, an appendage for the purpose of detecting that sort of thing. I think that's why we said for many years that women had greater intuition than men.
Yeah.
You know, they were the other side of the brain. And they were using their hair, you know, to detect information
mm-hmm.
that other people didn't get to get because they did not have that warning system or whatever it is that hair is. But it is...
well, I have enough of it. Hope it helps.
Yeah, well, you know, I really think that you can't get enough awareness. And there are times when I've been close to overload. I've been so aware of so much. And deliberately saturating myself in atmospheric weirdness, you know, like going to a rock show or a light show or a convention or a gathering of... I like people. I love being around them. My profession calls for me to enjoy quite a bit of solitude where I just am thinking and I'm alone and there's nothing happening. And it's boring as hell unless I can think of a game to involve myself in. It's called a story or a script or an idea, just an idea. Because they do come out of nowhere. You think, hey, that's interesting, and you look at something. Now, how can I take the fact that it has that property of being interesting and apply it to what I'm doing? You know, and oftentimes I'll put in a word into a sentence. I'm not sure why. I just happen to like the word cerulean. I love it. Cerulean blue. It's a kind of blue.
It is alizarin
pretty. Alizarin crimson. I like those words. I'd love to get that word alizarin somehow in a sentence if I were talking about her lips or something.
Hmm.
And there's that word. Bam! It'll just leap off the page and smash you in the face because it's so musically, profoundly, alluringly bizarre. It's alizarin. Alizarin.
Hmm.
And I hear all kinds of things in that word. And so for me, I really do like them. I like words. I really hate the fact that everything's prefab. Almost everybody's conversation is made of bits and pieces.
Yeah.
You've heard too many times already. And it's just refreshing to come across a sentence that's brand new, that probably has never been spoken before. I'll give you one. I made it up. I think it's a good sentence.
Okay.
Darkness is faster than light.
Well, I believe it, too.
It's profound, isn't it?
Yeah.
Darkness is faster than light.
Yeah.
But what is this fastness you're talking about relative to darkness? You know, in what way are you smearing things together in an unreal, fantasy, imaginary way? But it speaks of profoundness to the deep within you, and you even would think he's onto something there. You know, because darkness is definitely faster than light. You go to it, you know, it's there. Everywhere you go, bam, it's there. How did it get there? Because it's faster. You know, and so here's another profound thought. You get beat down getting to the top.
I love that. I do love that.
I'd like to write a whole book made of just sentences that I don't think have ever been printed before.
You should do it.
Yeah. It's so challenging, though, to find those fresh sentences that you can't, that aren't part of the common lingo.
Now, I do want to ask you a question about something that I had no clue about, and going through some of the stuff online last night about you and your life, I came across this, and I was like, really? And I'm just going to say the name of the place, and then you can tell us about it. Cafe Frankenstein.
It was a remarkable adventure. I borrowed money, $500, from Prudential Insurance Company.
Wow.
To invest in this little proposition that consisted of three guys. It was Doug Myers, who was a folk singer and a guitarist, quite a good one, and he was with the Gateway Singers at the time, mm-hmm. when I first met him, and a fellow named Bert Schoenberg, who was a painter, and I had just met him and was starting to acquire some of his paintings. I have a house full of them now, and they're pretty quite valuable.
Wow.
Because the guy turned out to be just a remarkable artist, and his work has penetrated most everywhere.
Wow.
Anyway, these three of us decided that there was an old lumberyard that had almost burnt, but got put on, out, but was still sort of condemned, and they weren't in the future going to build anything there. And there was a little thing shaped like a hot dog stand, you know, like the inside of a vehicle, only it wasn't a vehicle. It was a little wooden building. And we went and searched this place out, and it seemed to be a perfectly likely place to put tables and chairs and candles and girls in leotards and cups with the Frankenstein creature on them and stained glass windows and paintings and the whole hip, I mean, we called it beat quality that was there. So these bunch of beatniks opened this place called Cafe Frankenstein. It was illustrated with pictures of the creature playing chess with a monster from outer space. Its chess pieces looked like it. The monster's pieces looked like its head. And it was there it was. And it was a painting in plastic underneath Krylon crystal clear outside. There it was. And it was wonderfully preserved and beautifully protected by there. And anyway, we've opened this place. On an average, it cost us about $3,000 a month to pay all the bills.
Wow.
Including the waitresses. We made about $3,000 a month at 85 cents a cup for espresso coffee and a bunch of stuff like that. And we stayed open very, very late, and we were able to use acoustic instrumentation in a time when the Trillo and the Musicians Union had clamped down on amplified music, and they were going to charge a certain amount if you belonged to the union, and the union was showing its muscle to show just how deeply it affected industry. And so it was really affecting industry, but not acoustic instruments like the guitar or the oboe or something. So we started recruiting people to play there or to dance there. Flamenco dancer, come. We can give you a table to dance on and a fast, you know, imitation of Vicente Gomez, and off you go. And we produced this wonderful program of hip happenings. We attracted a guy who came and just started hanging out at first with a typewriter. And he'd ingratiate himself with some people and sit down at their table, ask them a few questions and type a few pages, give them the page, and then get ready to leave, and they'd press money up on him, and he'd say thank you, and he'd look around for the next customer. And he was very good at asking you about what movie you just recently saw, or have you ever been out of this state? And just take your lessons, and he'll extract a sentence. Oh, yes, she remembers a trip she took to Oklahoma, and the sparkle in her eyes as she talked about those days, da-da-da-da-da. And he goes on with his schmooze with dot-dot-dot in between electric sentences, and people paid for it, and it became part of the entertainment. You go to the Cafe Frankenstein if you want on paper to tell you just how absolutely splendid you, how bright and attentive and you know. But he was good at it. His name was Jack. And we did that for 3 solid years. It was ups, it was downs. We got busted once.
Yep.
This is the high point of our adventure there. Was it was 3 in the morning. The place was closed. I was inside. There was a model there named Barbara Freda Kellogg.
What a memory.
Known as Bobby. And sometimes Freddie. And Freddie was a gorgeous girl. And Ronald Black Vogel was a Playboy centerfold photographer who had got this assignment from Escapade magazine to shoot the Cafe Frankenstein. And he brought along Barbara Kellogg. And I was there as the owner of the place, one of them, and we were shooting this stuff with candles in front of the stained glass mural of Frankenstein, and she's holding her little cup, and click, click, there's a bunch of banging on the door, and I go to peek out, and the door's shoved open, and a half a dozen people, including 2 police officers, bust in the place, and look around, aha!
Gotcha.
In the act. And we are all frozen. What the hell can this possibly be? 3 o'clock in the morning, we're not bothering anybody. We're doing this for a legitimate magazine. This company has been around for 2 years, whatever it turned out to be. And what they hail. Anyway, off we are carried to this pokey. We're locked in. I take all the money out of the cash register, so just in case we get an opportunity to bail ourselves out, which we did. Contacted a lawyer in Beverly Hills, of all places, a man named Mr. Firestone. And Firestone came to Laguna Beach and was there appearing with us, along with an associate friend of his. And the judge says, oh, well, first comes the grand hoorah, which was us going around to the newspapers and interviewing ourselves and having us telling our tale and getting it into their damn paper about how these police powers are getting out of hand and they are going to decide who should be in this city and who shouldn't be
so
in this city.
So, what were the charges?
Well, it was a somewhat vague, but it was illegal. I don't know. It had to do with that photography, though.
Oh, I see.
But whatever it was, but by this time, everybody is embarrassed. God damn, we've made a front-page story about the iniquities of the goddamn police force deciding to, you know, and my God. And, of course, they caught our tone beautifully and expressed that to the world at large. And we appeared in a courtroom where the judge was saying to our attorneys, well, before we begin these proceedings, don't you think you ought to make a motion? And he said, a motion. They looked at each other, almost. And the judge says, oh, yeah, I think, and he gets into this business that you should maybe make a motion. And they suddenly get it. They say, well, we'd like to move to have this case dismissed on the lack of da-da-da-da. And the judge says, dismissed, and that was the end of that. That was our trial right there. And but it was an expression of the power of the people. Because they wanted Cafe Frankenstein. It was a colorful spot. Their young people would go there on their prom night. You know, they'd put on their beautiful dresses and gowns and tuxedos and show up and spend money on Italian ices and other things, including watch the flamenco dancer or whatever that is performing. And it was a very colorful era during which I saw the term beatnik replaced by the word hippie.
Right.
They were coterminous. But it was also the years of the Twilight Zone, because I was working at my Cafe Frankenstein on and off while I was writing episodes of the Twilight Zone television program.
Wow.
During the 60s, it was all part of this, all the kids flooding in to the West Coast, the summer of love. A whole bunch of heroes jumped out of the woodwork here, Allen Ginsberg, Ken Kesey, all those people. And it's caused a ferment on all levels, which in television was expressed by the Twilight Zone, the permission to think in other categories.
Yeah.
What if we all only had one hand? What would happen to the peanut butter jars then? You know. So this ability to think of the imaginary, fostered by everybody from Edgar Rice Burroughs to Ray Bradbury, and a certain cultural milieu in which it became very clear to me that that was the literature of the future, and that as a writer I had to find out how to do that. And I did, by becoming first a forger of Ray Bradbury stories. I could forge a Bradbury story in a minute. and it would be made out of his lumber. It would use his parse, his syntax, his language. It would have his awe and wonder at age 14 mentality behind it, because I was 15 going on 16, and they're able to chameleon-like perform the act of pretending I was 14.
My favorite Ray Bradbury, George, is The Illustrated Man.
Amazing story.
Yes. Sorry, I distracted
you. Bradbury is that sort of way. He's a magician.
Yeah.
He tends to just sort of shock you.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just recently read a story of his in a collection that I have a story in, so I read his story. And his story has to do with a guy making this lonely drive up through this beautiful country and finally pulling into this little cemetery, parking the car and walking over to this gravesite, and there's a bench, and he sits there, and he looks at this grave, and he thinks. And another guy comes along and sits on the bench and says, "Friend of yours? Yeah, yeah. Do you knew this guy? Yeah, yeah." So they start comparing notes, and it finally gets to his reason for being here, and then he confesses this place quite frequently, because this kid had it all when he was young. And he died. God bless it. He died, and now he's dead. Thank God, you know, he's no longer around, because he was just went into the shade when he was around. And this guy hated his guts, and that was his reason for being there every year, was because he just had 1,000 reasons to detest the guy's very, very existence on Earth. And I thought, what an astonishing idea. Bradbury takes his idea of mourning and turns it on its head and astonishes you by using the prosaic language of the bereaved, and it's not bereavement at all. It's rather a satisfaction that I finally got a chance to spend the morning here. It warms my bones to know that he's dead then.
Yeah.
You know, so Ray Bradbury, once again, just keeps a bunch jumping in there. There's another writer named Alfred de Bester. I recommend him.
Okay.
There's a story which probably by now everybody has read, called The Stars, My Destination. And he has another one called The Demolished Man. And many a short story, like Fondly Fahrenheit, an amazing author. His books are both all classics, and I think The Stars, My Destination is the number one sci-fi book out there. I think Logan may be number two, because I copied a lot of what Bester was trying to do in my attitude toward this thriller that Bill and I wrote. I was thinking like Bester, because he had a real Dashiell Hammett hardness about him as well as a lyricism. You know, Ray was sort of limited in that region because he's such a benevolent guy. He hardly ever really shows any good, clean-cut malice that you often can get out of a Mike Hammer or a Mickey Spillane.
Yeah.
Both of whom I admired tremendously as authors.
Yeah.
And wanted to be a lot like them.
Now, I have a few minutes left till our next show comes. We're going to roll on up until she gets here. That, of course, is Jay Allday with Cincinnati's Conscience. But in the meantime, we're going to keep rolling until she gets here at WVQC LP Cincinnati. It is, of course, Hemp Rock Radio, and our special guest today is George Clayton Johnson, writer of many, many things, including, last but not least, that I want to mention, of course, is Ocean's 11. And so I have a quick question on that, George. As you know, George Clooney is doing numerous series of movies from the original, Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13. I have a couple questions on that. First of all, of course, you know he's a local boy. So we have a George here, your namesake. And that's who, of course, has done that. So I kind of feel like a home connection to that since he's taken that over. How does that work for you since you're the co-writer of the original book? Go ahead.
I have to tell you, I love George Clooney.
I do too.
See, I think he's just the Clark Gable of our age.
Yes.
I think he's a great treasure and a real credit to the world. So he'll be taking an interest in the story and bringing in people like Brad Pitt and that stirred me.
You know what I say? All of his stoner buddies.
Yeah, really. They were a wonderful rat pack of their own.
That's it.
A group.
They are.
But when I look at that, I think, oh, well, that's really great to be part of a franchise.
Yeah.
Like James Bond. Who knows, they might want to do more.
Yeah.
Ocean stories, because it's a colorful idea, a band of thieves. You know, that's always very interesting. But I was disappointed in the execution of it. I thought there was a lot of effort and good acting and sweet moments. But all in all, I thought, gee, this is something you got to... A movie that was kind of lame, and you got the original script to go back to, which was very tense and tough. Hmm. And so along the way, so much gets lost.
Yeah.
I see the same thing happened with Logan's Run.
Yeah.
Nolan and I wrote a beautiful Logan's Run script.
I know they changed it.
For George Patel.
Yeah.
Back in the days when he was to be the producer.
They changed the ending of it, didn't they?
They changed everything. They just kept remaking the damn story as best they could imagine it might possibly go.
Yeah.
And they ignored the script that Nolan and I wrote. I kept calling it to their attention. I sent memos to the offices of Joel Silver's production company, who works for Warner Brothers and is now doing Logan's Run, I'm told, one more time.
Now,
it has been announced.
Is that going to be closer to the original story?
I have yet to learn anything. I send out my feelers. I talk to strange people, but I never get the straight goods. Let me look at a script. I'd love to see what it looks like. I'd contribute to it. If a guy could figure a way to improve it, I would.
Yeah.
And I'm a qualified guy to do that.
Obviously.
But that's really the obvious problem, is they don't want to get me around there. You know, why? You don't want your grandfather looking over your shoulder criticizing everything you do.
If you were my grandfather, I would love to have you looking over my shoulder and criticizing me. That would be a blessing.
I would love to do it too, Lynn. You're a very, very nice person. I like you a lot.
You are too, George. You're so sweet. And by the way, you know, we tried to get you on last week. I tried to get a hold of you on Sunday a week ago. It was George's 82nd birthday on July 10th. And so we're going to give you a happy birthday today, a week belated. And I want folks to know about that. And I feel honored. My own mother had her birthday the following day. You guys almost share a birthday. So... Now, it's funny, I know you're getting ready to do Comic-Con in the next few days. Have you ever gone to Dragon-Con?
Yes, I have.
Have you made it down there? That's
the
great.
The Arizona people. They put, in fact, the Dark-Con, one of their conventions, honored me and Bill. We were guests of honor 1 year.
Well, I happened to catch episode on PBS last night, or a couple nights ago, actually, about Dragon Con this year's already that happened in Atlanta. And I'll tell you, that is one place I belong. if I can ever go. I don't know if I would, if I could even choose a costume to be, but I would want to go and just experience it. It looks like a lot of fun.
I am writing a musical drama.
Yeah?
Named Madame Zola, and my agent is telling me that he can get any regional theater, probably, to read it. And that would include Atlanta. And I'm thinking, my goodness, should I go release my new musical drama?
At Dragon Con.
Opera at Dragon Con.
That would be fantastic. It certainly would fit in.
I have helped to form something called the Sheldorf Fan Club. Shell was the founder of the San Diego Comic-Con, along with a handful of other people, mostly children, who put on those first few conventions. Ray Bradbury went to the first one, and I went to that one because he did, and therefore have gone to all 40 convention. I may have missed one along the way for one reason or another, but that was then my goal. I recently went to their 40th anniversary and renewed friendships with a lot of older artists that I hadn't seen for years because it had become such a big financial deal and had so many people coming to a big convention center, and there was no human heart to it anymore. And we said, let us form a fan club. And the next thing you know, we've got 100 people signed up, big ones.
Wow.
Stan Lee, Ray Bradbury, signed up to be part of the Sheldorf fan club. And we've been giving out awards called the Best Friend of Fandom Award. And we have been honoring each other and getting people like Roy Thomas to sign the damn certificates. And it's just turned into a monumental triumph. We've affected the convention. They've already given us Saturday night in the upstairs lounge of the, what, some kind of a thing with a sailcloth ceiling on it. And they've let us have a big party from 8:30 or 8 o'clock to 11 or something. And my God, what an honor, because here's this soulless organization, and now they're recognizing that we've stuck the soul back in it, whether they liked it or not, and formed a fan club that's ever growing, because we're also doing another award called the Planet El Cortez, the Downward Room Award. You ever go there sometime, go to the El Cortez Hotel.
Okay.
Their dining room is called the Don Room, and the ceiling of it is carved wood, and it's just an insanely wonderful space. And we used to go there every year as part of the Comic-Con during the 70s and the early part of the 80s. And as a result, all of those persons who sort of bonded at this wonderful hotel now are resurfacing as a fan club dedicated to the founder. And it's taking off like amazing to me. It started out with six of us. We called ourselves the Gang of Six. And the Gang of Six started to promote this Sheldorf fan club and sign up people to join. And it's free, so they're happy to do it.
Yeah.
And but it's wonderful. Well, an artist named Joe Kubert, he's in his late 80s or early 90s. He's elderly or more than me. But his art credentials go back so far. I consider him the best artist of Tarzan. I think he did a comic book on Tarzan that captured more the Edgar Rice Burroughs book and story than anything I'd read up to that period. Just wonderfully cinematic. I learned how to write movies and TV from being able to read comic books and see how to paste one tableau to move it into the next tableau. And you could, if you did that properly and it was a good artist illustrating the storyline, you had a good movie in your head by reading a comic book.
You so know, go ahead.
Well, I'm just trying to give you part of the reason why I have spent so much energy and time promoting comics.
Well, you know, it's funny, in looking through all the different works that you've done, besides the things that we've mentioned, you've written an episode for Alfred Hitchcock. Another show that I loved, Route 66, one of the Honey West, which now is airing in the middle of the night late. I'm going to try to catch the episode, The Flame and the Pussycat, on that show. And, of course, Kung Fu, one of the episodes of Kung Fu. And you don't know, I have a cat named after the character Kwai Chang Kane, the second cat named after that character. And I am a huge fan since I was a kid. And then I see, of course, and I think it's really cool, you've actually acted. You've got four things listed.
I was with a film with William Shatner.
Wow.
William Shatner is my hero in this, and I'm a racist bigot, so you can imagine what Bill is.
Is that The Intruder or The Crustacean?
The Intruder.
The Intruder.
Yes,
wow.
I merely play me in Crustacean, but in this I play this really savage, racist guy.
Wow.
And I enjoyed it. God, that was so fun to let that part of me out and yell the N-word as loud as I could. I just loved it.
And of course, A Sea Hunt. That's on a few couple times a night on this TV. I'm going to try to catch that episode with you in it. And now this is the good one. I'm gonna watch Burn Man's face when I say this. In Her Morbid Desires, you play an opium smoking vampire.
I do. I'm keen. They made a beautiful photo of it and presented it to me under glass, and it's just
Fantastic.
It's a really gorgeous photo of me wearing this big straw hat dressed in this dark cloak and holding this opium pipe.
That is so cool.
I'm marvelous. Yes, I like the idea. Forrest Ackerman was another guy that did that. We get an opportunity to play in some schlock movie, we'd immediately say, yes, let's do it.
Sure.
But sometimes the movies turn into something wonderful, like The Intruder. I consider it eligible to win the Academy Award that year.
Wow.
Had it not been jerked from circulation by Pathé Films, that up until that time had a release date on it, but when they found out that it the kind of a movie it was, political and all of that, they withdrew their patronage right away.
Can anybody get copies of it?
Yeah, now it's being released. It's marketed out there.
Wonderful.
The Intruder, or under Roger Corman. It's one of his.
It's one of Roger. What a great guy.
Yeah, I got to know Roger quite well during this shoot.
Well, I'll tell you what my favorite movie is. Not only one of my favorite of all-time sci-fis, but my favorite Roger Corman movie. And it's so funny. Elvira did it on her show over the weekend. Teenage Caveman.
that had Robert, what's his name?
Robert Vaughn. Now, see, here's a trivia where I can take a segue. We were talking about George Clooney before, and now, of course, talking about the last thing with Man from U.N.C.L.E., Robert Vaughn. George Clooney is coming out in 2012 with a new movie, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which was another one of my crazy, crazy things when I was a kid that I loved. So can you imagine George Clooney playing Napoleon Solo?
Yes, I can.
I can, too. He's, like, perfect.
I have written a screenplay called Ryan, The Love of Heinrich Haidt. Huh. Heinrich Haidt was my nickname for the thing while it was being written, but now it's called Ryan, and I'd love to have George Clooney play the Humphrey Bogart part in this.
Yeah.
I wrote it as though it were going to be another picture with Bogart and Bacall, the snotty young girl who's so sure she's got it under control.
Yeah.
And the guy who's too busy being a hero to give her much attention. And it works. God, it really works as a chemistry for an actor and an actress. And I can see Clooney playing the Bogart thing, although I can't picture for the life of me anybody cool enough to play the young lady.
Wow. Well, you know, you've put the thought out there, so it's going to happen.
Yeah, right on. Hey, another thought, since you mentioned it. I reread a script of mine called The Demon God that I wrote for the Kung Fu show.
Yes, that was the episode.
So I am rereading the script, and it made me cry.
Oh, wow.
I will confess that to you. I'm sitting here reading the last pages of this, and I realize, my God, George, you're weeping here over this script of yours you wrote over 10 years since you last looked at the damn thing. Anyway, I've got a book called Photogenic Fiction, and it has 7 such scripts. It's got a Star Trek. It's got a Route 66, to name one, or the Twilight Zone, to name another. Anyway, 7 scripts from various network television programming during the 60s. Which I think sort of defines an era and a time in TV that no longer exists or functions the way it did then. And so I'm hoping I can get a publisher like Gauntlet or Subterranean to publish it in the form of a big, thick, fat compendium which represents the life's work of yours truly in TV.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, George, I wish we could chat the rest of the day, but unfortunately, our burn man's sitting here. He's got to get out to the 420 appliance repair people and get some washing machines fixed.
To you and to your audience, farewell, then, and until we talk again.
Absolutely. And I want to do that. You know, we've talked a lot about your work and different stuff, but we only had a few minutes there to let you talk about philosophy and things that you think about when you're just thinking. And that's what I would like to do sometime in the future. Maybe next month we'll work you back in on another Monday after Comic-Con. And after you get some of those things done that you're working on, and just talk philosophy. What do you think?
Perfectly fine with me, Lynn. I love it.
I love talking to you, and I love hearing you talk about that kind of stuff. So that's you know, and I want you to know that although I'm doing this for the listeners, this is really my dream. I'm fulfilling one of my thoughts and my dreams to be able to have conversation with not only other people like yourself, but specifically you. And I want to thank you for that, for being a part of my dream.
Well, you're very, very welcome.
Well, we're going to go
myself,
ahead.
I myself feel that I've lived a charmed life.
Yes.
And I hope that at a certain point you look at your progress through the world and think, my God, it is true. I had a desire. I went for it. It began to take shape. There was another rock to leap to in my trying to get across this river. But here I go to the next rock, and my God, they're appearing miraculously. And after a while, you look around, and for the hidden hand that's pulling the strings, because it's very unlikely some of these coincidences. After 82 years, I'm beginning to get a pretty good line on how that works. And I'm telling you, look forward to the next event, because you can shape your life by just willing it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Take good care, and God bless you all.
That's one of the secrets of the universe that you've taught me. So thank you for exposing that truth to me. Well, of course, it is Hemp Rock Radio, and this is George Clayton Johnson. Many, many things and many more to come. George, thank you very, very much, and we will talk to you again very, very soon.
It is a deal, and thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, George. Anyway, I'm the Happy Hemptress. It's Hemp Rock Radio here at WVQC LP Cincinnati, 95.7 FM and WVQC.org. And we will be back tomorrow, same time, same place, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. All righty.
This has been the Monday edition of Hemp Rock Radio with the Happy Hemptress, the Burn Man, and the Potsberry Dope Boy Pot and Hash. Hemp Rock Radio airs Mondays and Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern on WVQC LP. Find Hemp Rock Radio archives at weedradionetwork.com.
Watch Hemp Rock TV on Northern Kentucky's Insight Cable Channel 21, Cincinnati's Time Warner Cable Channel 4 and 24, and now online at weedradionetwork.com.
You can join the Hemp Rockers list at HempRock.com and the Hemp Rock Hemp Line at 513-684-HEMP. That's 513-684-HEMP. To help end Cincinnati's harmful marijuana ordinance, please visit CincinnatiMarijuanaLaw.com. That's CincinnatiMarijuanaLaw.com. Hemp Rock Radio, the Potsberry Bakery, and Hemp Rock Cafe are brought to you by Hemp Rock Productions. Thanks for listening to Hemp Rock Radio and Radio Free Queen City, a member of Media Bridges Community Media Center on 95.7 FM, WVQC-LP, Cincinnati. WVQC-LP broadcasts from Cincinnati's Computer Cooperative Studios. You can listen online, become a member, and support the station at WVQC.org. Coming up next on WVQC-LP is Jay All Day with Cincinnati's Conscience, where hippie meets the hood.